I'm Rob Jessel. Now, in these times of lockdown, it might seem like we've all had to hit the pause button, but FairCop continues to be very busy behind the scenes while we're all cooped up in quarantine. And I'm delighted to welcome back FairCop's top legal brains, Anna and Sarah, who are joining me, of course, over a conference call. Welcome to you both.
Hello.
Now, as many of our listeners know, the judgment in Harry Miller versus the police was not a complete victory because Mr. Justice Knowles ruled in favour of the College of Policing, although he did give us, he did grant us leave to appeal to the Supreme Court if necessary. So, Anna, can you give us an update on where we stand on this appeal and maybe take listeners through the process, especially for those who may not be familiar with the workings of the High Court and Supreme Court?
Yes, well, obviously the High Court is high up in the scheme of things. So it's quite unusual for High Court cases to be transferred directly to the Supreme Court for an appeal, as in this case. I think that what I would take from that is the content examined by the judge, the legal content, the legal principles at work are of extreme public significance and possibly also constitutional significance as well. And I think the judge, Justice Knowles, realised that, and although his judgment, as was extensively covered in the press and in law blogs and on the FairCop Twitter feed and by many commentators, as we recognise that the judgment found partly for Harry and partly for his rights, his Article 10 rights, it also, rather frustratingly for some, found for the College of Policing. Found their guidance to be lawful. And so we were left with a sort of strange quandary as to clarity. If Humberside did not act lawfully following the guidance that was lawful, then what police officer, what police force can be sure that they are acting lawfully following that same guidance? Mm. And I think Justice Knowles recognised on some fundamental level that there were several questions to be resolved of public importance, of constitutional importance, around our fundamental rights to freedom of expression, our fundamental rights to privacy, to the presumption of innocence, and to provide safeguarding against overreach by the police and other public bodies. And I think that's why he had no objection to us transferring the case to the Supreme Court, and neither did the College of Policing. So we find ourselves now not only at the highest level in the UK, because the Supreme Court is the most senior court in the United Kingdom, but we find ourselves at a leading court in the common law world. The whole world will be watching this case, which, you know, is going to examine points of law of general public importance and constitutional significance. For those of you who don't know much about the Supreme Court itself, it's worth also just saying a little bit about the building, which is located in Parliament Square. And it only been located there since 2009, because prior to that, the so-called Law Lords sat in the House of Lords in Parliament itself. And so the separation of the Supreme Court from parliamentary buildings, giving it its own building in Parliament Square, is very symbolic. Its existence marking the independence of the judiciary and its separation from political power. So I think, you know, we've seen how the Supreme Court has developed a very symbolic role in our society, particularly since the aptly named Miller case in November of 2019, which took the government to task over prorogation of Parliament. And there was much debate about whether the Supreme Court was playing an overtly political role, not seeming behaviour for the judicial authority. But I think it's very symbolic that Harry Miller's case finds itself in that building, because some of the issues that we are going to be examining as part of the appeal relate to constitutional issues as well. Namely, whether or not an individual such as Harry Miller would have to go to a high court judge to make a political ruling every time he chooses to tweet on a political matter, such as, you know, reform of the Gender Recognition Act. So I hope that's not too much of a long-winded introduction to
the case. No,
that's just an overview of where we are.
I mean, I think what I get from that, and sort of what I felt before, is going to the Supreme Court is a really big deal. As you say, the whole world is watching, and not many cases go to the Supreme Court. I understand they only really review about 10-12 cases a year, so the fact that the Faircock is going to go in front of the Supreme Court has is a reflection, would you say, on quite how seriously the British judiciary are taking this, and how aware they are of the conflict of rights that's going on right now. So let's turn to Sarah. Can you tell us a bit more about the progress of our case, and also the implications that it's going to have on everything, on policing, equality, law, hate crime, and so forth?
Well, I think it was a fantastic result. I don't think we could actually hope for any better, because although the High Court is very important, it's still only the High Court. And I don't think a single judge in the High Court could have overturned the hate crime operational guidance, because the point was made quite powerfully on behalf of the police that this is something that's a European-wide measure. This is seen as a good thing that we have these subjective interpretations of victimhood. Now, I think the lid of that can of worms needs to come blasting off, because we've seen the law of unintended consequences, always my favourite law, come into play. And we've seen how people will abuse that and will identify themselves as victims for really ignoble purposes. And perhaps one of the best things about the whole case for me was the way the judge was so firm, polite but firm, in his description of Mrs. B's criticisms of Harry Miller. I think my favourite phrase was the outer edges of rationality.
For those of you who aren't aware, Mrs. B is the original complainant on which the entire police case was based. It's well worth checking out, if you haven't already, Mrs. B's statement in full, which is included in the judgment given by Mr. Justice Knowles, a link to which will be at the bottom of this podcast.
Now, that's really powerful, and I was really pleased about that, because I think this is exactly the mess that we're getting into. And I hope we can go on and just discuss our recent correspondence with the Equality and Human Rights Commission, because I think that's very tied into why this is so important. And Anna's right. I think the world will be watching. To leapfrog to the Supreme Court was absolutely the best thing that could have happened. This case isn't going to dwindle away in some appellate court. It's going to go straight to one of the most important courts in the world. And I'm beyond pleased. I think this is a real opportunity to try and wrestle back law and sense from the postmodernists. And I think the damage that they're doing to the fabric of society, not just the rights of individuals, is immense. So I don't know much about the progress, other than I think it's launched, it's ready to go. It will be happening. Of course, we're in a time of national crisis, so that's going to have an impact on timescales. But this autumn, fingers crossed. I don't know. I don't know how quickly they operate, because obviously my practice doesn't trouble the Supreme Court that often. But I'm really, really hoping that the autumn is going to be very interesting indeed.
I just want to spool back a bit and to say, was Mr. Justice Knowles' judgment in part a realisation that this is something that has to go to the highest court in the land, and he didn't want to make a judgment on it because he knew it was something that needed the oversight of the most senior judges in the land?
Well, I think the fact that he said he was amenable to a leapfrog appeal has to support that. I certainly think he was very conscious of the weight of his decision. I thought his reference to literature, to wider quotations, showed he's really sat and thought about this. But he's also conscious of his role. I mean, judges can't be political. I think to have struck down the hate crime operational guidance at that stage of the court process would be arguably a judge overstepping the mark. It's something so significant. I think it has to be considered by a much higher court. And maybe they will also feel that it's politically impermissible, but the messages they could give in their judgment would be very powerful. And I think government would be foolish to ignore it. So that's my hope. I mean, I don't know if Anna feels the same way.
I do. I agree. I think he has compiled a judgment carefully, and we know that it took some time. And we wondered why it took time. And when we read it, I think most of us realised that he had wrestled with some of the more complex issues, the legal and constitutional issues that Carrie's case touches upon, and realised that they weren't, that the High Court wasn't the proper place to address all of those issues in one fell swoop. And so he compiled this judgment, and it reads... I mean, it is a very intelligent judgment, and Justice Knowles is a very intelligent man. It's very well read, very well written, and it is very erudite. It is, however, what a friend of mine would call divinely ambiguous, in that you are dealing with having cakes and eating them at every step of the way. You can see how there is grave concern on the part of the judge, hence his reference to the Stasi and the Cheka and what have you, and Orwell. There's grave concern that we are opening up the channels in our society for public authorities to operate without any accountability whatsoever. He understands that this has to be checked.
Yes.
However, there's a tension in our society, in our administration, if you like, between data collection and powers that have been given through the common law to institutions like the police to compile data for the good of the society as a whole, which is seen as a largely objective, impassive, neutral and non-political exercise. Mm. And that exists, and that is right, and that was recognized by the judge. But there's a tension between that and the deployment of exactly the same kind of operations using monitoring forms online or filling in reports of people's concerns that are phoned in or emailed in, and politicizing them through policies which are built up over years under the auspices of so-called hate crime or hate incident monitoring. And he recognizes that the one thing and the other thing are two wholly different things. They're qualitatively different things. One is objective and administrative, and the other is political and subversive and also highly subjective. And the police have no place in adjudicating, you know, what constitutes a hate crime. That's the business of the judge. So he, I think, knew that had to be unpacked, and it couldn't be unpacked without delivering it to a higher court, because the higher court's going to have to examine the policies that we took to task in the judicial review and actually ask the real question, which is, can these policies be produced without statutory footing that curtail our rights? Because if so, then we're now in a constitutionally different situation than we thought we were, where we thought that our rights were guaranteed by Acts of Parliament and were therefore accountable in terms of, you know, us being able to have a say in how we feel about it. And if that's not the case, then the Supreme Court is the proper place to establish that.
Yes, I think it's, just to spool back, you make some very interesting points about the judgment and how the conflict between those opposing rights was very clear. And I think what you see there is Mr. Justice Knowles really struggling to introduce as much balance as he can. And at times, I would say that the judgment is slightly contradictory, especially where especially where, you know, it fines for the College of Policing, but against homicide, and it's almost a recognition that, you know, as you say, this is a constitutional issue. This is it's a point of statute, because
Common law legality as well. How do we know that the policies are lawful that the police are following? That traces us back to either principles of common law or statutory acts of parliament. And, you know, people can't take up policies and approaches to policing on a whim and just churn out whatever rules they see fit without any accountability whatsoever. And I think that's what the judge realised needs to be exposed.
So there was a lot of crowing from some of our opponents, who I won't name, that this case didn't set any precedent at all. It only really applied to Harry's tweets, and that everybody else can then suffer the attentions of the law if they tweet the wrong thing on sex and gender. But are we in a sort of phony war period now, while we wait for the Supreme Court case to start? Or has the work of Fair Cop and Harry actually led to changes in the police? But are we starting to see any change in the way that the police are approaching cases like this, Sarah?
Well, I think we are. I just want to say, I'm really surprised if anyone's crowing, saying, this isn't a precedent. Well, of course, a High Court case is of limited precedent value. You need to start going to the Court of Appeal and beyond. This is leapfrogging to the Supreme Court. So what do they think is coming? An absolutely whopper of a precedent. So that will be very interesting. And I don't think it's worth wasting energy sort of crowing who won, who lost. What is clear is that this judge agreed it needs to be looked at by the highest court in the land. So that's certainly a victory for the level of examination I think this needs. I mean, I can only speak anecdotally, but I think there's been a massive shift. I mean, I've been saying things on Twitter, for example, that I think a year ago I might have got a knock on the door from the police. And I think it's not just Harry's case. We've seen quite a lot of people attempted to start legal actions and then pulled back, or it fizzled out. Because I think they began to realise that the more the public saw what was happening, the less support they had, because they were simply being so unreasonable. So I think it's a combination of lots of factors. But I sense a change. I don't know what you guys feel, but I certainly have been quite surprised. I've woken up and I've still got a Twitter account. Because I have said things which I know have got other women suspended permanently for saying. So there does seem to be a shift. But obviously that's just anecdotal. I haven't looked at the stats and seen how many people are being arrested for hate crimes now as opposed to 6 months ago.
And I think Harry's been approached directly by Humberside and by other parties to say that they are aware that this is ongoing, that the guidance needs revising, that it is being revised, that there are all sorts of implications potentially coming out of the Supreme Court case. So the awareness on the side of the police is definitely, it's not, what's the word I'm looking for? They're not taking this lightly. They understand the seriousness of the moment. And I think there's an appetite on their part for more robust and lawful guidance that they can understand and follow with full confidence that they're not breaking the law.
Absolutely, because this isn't about criticising the police. It's about wanting them to have guidance that they can work with. I mean, they do, as we all know, a tremendously difficult and dangerous job. And I don't think that they've been helped at all. Because I did just want to touch on the dialogue we tried to get going with the Equality and Human Rights Commission. Because I think this ties pretty much what we're talking about, in that the police have become politicised. Harry's speech was recognised to be political speech. And we all became quite worried over the last couple of months at how police forces appear to be focusing simply on one protected characteristic under the Equality Act, and then a characteristic which doesn't even appear in the Equality Act, and that is gender identity or some vague term. So we wrote to the Equality and Human Rights Commission. I think it was on the 19th of February. Mm. And we said, look, we're really concerned. This seems to be totally out of balance. Where are the police force with special liveried cars and flags and parades for disabled people or religious people or people of other races? We're not seeing it. And it does really trouble me because the Equality and Human Rights Commission was set up distinctly. Its general duty includes fostering mutual respect between communities. And what I think we're seeing here is something that's very divisive, a focus on identifying and protecting just one group. And actually, I know it's a phrase I've used a lot, but I stand by it, the police almost becoming the private militia of one particular group. Mm. So all of this is swirling around. And I think all of this, the Supreme Court will have to take notice of, because the original intent of the McPherson guidelines was, of course, incredibly noble. But I think it's been hijacked to a really dangerous extent. So I'm really hoping we get a response from the EHRC. I appreciate now is not the best of times, but I would have hoped the issues that we raised were serious, were substantial, and I'd like to at least get an acknowledgement of what they think is happening with the police.
Yes, I think a large part of the judgment and why it was so... was because Justice Knowles recognised that there does need to be some mechanism in place where society and the law can judge a crime motivated by hate to be more worthy of opprobrium than other crimes, which I think we all sort of agree on, don't we, that we as a society do want to protect people based on protected characteristics.
Well, I mean, I'd like to chime in now very particularly because I'm wearing my disabled person's hat, and I am very frustrated that there does seem to be an element of magical thinking that if there's something we don't like and we want to stop, all we have to do is pass a law against it. And what we forget is that laws have to be applied consistently and fairly. Laws have to be understood. Laws have to be enforced. So I'm not, as a disabled person, really seeing that hate crimes, which purport to protect me as a disabled person, count for very much in the panoply of protection that I would want as a disabled person. And I would want more access to employment. I'd want more provision of services. More inclusivity in society as a whole. So I do wonder whether there is now an argument for going back to the Equality Act as a whole and looking at these protected characteristics and asking what are we really trying to achieve? Because I do think we've got to a stage where finding a workable definition of hate and asking who is responsible for that is just now too overwhelming to ask of our police force. And the answer has been, well, let's kick it back to the alleged victim, wholly subjective. And I think we've now seen how that's played out and the damage that has done. And I do feel very strongly that just more and more laws and more complicated definitions are getting in the way of policing. Everybody has a right to be free from physical attack and harassment. And I'm not sure that dividing us up into ever more categories that require... sorry about that.
Day 3 of lockdown.
Sorry about that.
We've got for you, keep
oh, shut... Oh, you bastard.
I think we should keep that in. That was an electric moment.
But will you shut up? I'm so sorry about this. They were fast asleep. They've just woken up. Right, I was making a really brilliant point, God damn you.
It was actually really brilliant. It was brilliant. It was brilliant.
Okay. I think I can remember where... I think I remember where I left off. The thing... What I'm concerned about is that slicing up humanity into smaller and smaller slices of individual differences that require protection is not the way to go about this. And I do feel that very strongly as a disabled person, because we're seeing what's happened. What's happened is everybody's focus and interest has been captured, literally captured by one particular group. and the rest of us minority groups aren't getting a look in. And I'm not confident from the Equality and Human Rights Commission's response or lack of it that they're actually going to step in and do what they're supposed to do. And I noted with interest that their funding has been absolutely cut to the bone. So there's so many big things here that need looking at, and I do hope the Supreme Court is going to touch on at least some of those. But yeah. I think it would be interesting to get the views of other protected characteristic people and see what they think of all of this, you know, what they feel about how their rights have been upheld within the criminal law and whether that actually does have the intended benefit on our wider rights in society.
Okay, so as we know, the courts and the judges don't make the law, but they can have a very big influence on the development of the law by pointing out problems and also absences of laws and guidelines that are not based on a statutory footing. So ultimately, this is going to be a question for the politicians. They've got to come in and they've got to give some proper oversight to the police and the College of Policing as part of their battle to grapple with these hate crimes laws, which are increasingly found to be not fit for purpose. My question is do politicians have the appetite to approach any problems that the Supreme Court highlights and to actually come up with a solution when we all know that they are being lobbied daily by groups that just want to ban free speech and shut people down as they unsuccessfully tried with Harry. How do we think it's going to work in Parliament when this question gets there?
I think there is an appetite and probably the most burning incentive for politicians to sort this out is that it affects them as much as it affects any other citizen. Politicians make comments all the time on social media and in interviews. And if we have very fuzzy definitions of what constitutes hate or unacceptable speech, which can be policed in any amount of, in any number of ways, if we have very shoddy definitions of which groups are vulnerable and protected under the law and which aren't, then politicians, like any citizen, are going to be vulnerable to that. And remember, this is because all of these definitions are subjective, such as the CPS definition of hate crime as, you know, anything that is perceived by any party to contain hostility of some kind. I mean, politicians have more enemies than the average citizen, and they are wanted to be taken down by their enemies. So they have a vested interest in having a civil society where people can express different and contentious views without being accused of being hate criminals. If we don't have that, we can't even have politicians putting different manifestos forward for the public, because any deviation from one position could be considered hateful. That's where we are. So there is an appetite in Parliament. And the two things that I think need to be addressed and addressed fast are the definition of hate as a subjective concept, that anybody who does anything I don't like, as I perceive it, can be seen objectively to have committed hate towards me. That's got to go. And the second is the protected characteristic, which under the Equality Act is 9 different characteristics, which are not well defined, continuously expanding and are open to abuse as they are redefined and hijacked and incorporated into all manner of policies by lobby groups who wish to push their own agendas, such as Stonewall and Mermaids, who've managed to turn gender reassignment into a massive panoply of cultural and social identities and behaviours that one must not criticise. And that's simply unacceptable. So I think that whilst the judges don't tell us what the law is, they can definitely show us through a Supreme Court judgment which areas of law are not working or not fit for purpose and in need of some kind of re-evaluation. And I think the politicians will take notice because it's in their interest to do so.
So we don't really know when our case will be heard, of course. I think we've all got our fingers crossed that it will be heard by the autumn, but no one really knows anything. So instead, let's divert things a bit. And Sarah, help take me through what a Supreme Court judgment looks like in this case and what the implications will be for politicians, say, if the High Court highlights that the police and the College of Policing have produced guidance that is unlawful? What do politicians then have to do if the Supreme Court rules that there's, you know, a major problem here?
Well, a Supreme Court judgment, from those I've read, is simply going to be Mr. Justice Knowles with knobs on. It's going to be very long. I'd imagine that every single law lord is going to want to have something to say. I mean, sometimes you'll just get one main judgment and all the other lords or ladies say, I agree. I would imagine something like this, you're going to get lengthy judgments from everybody chipping in, making points. I think it will be very, very interesting. Often they will invite interveners, interested parties to make submissions. So it's going to be a fascinating read, whatever side of the line you're on. And I think it's going to be so, so interesting because we've got some potentially huge things that they could shine a light on. And one of them, of course, is the extent to which we're asking the police to be the enforcers of these very vague and subjective rules about our behaviour. And I know this is something I think we want to touch upon in another podcast. It deserves its own topic. And I know it's something that concerns Anna very much, having experienced an Eastern European regime. But I'm just looking, a police force has just tweeted today, exercise is limited to around an hour per day and not more than once. Please stay home. Now that isn't the law. That's not what the law says. That's not what the recently produced legislation actually says. So it seems to me we're in a situation where the police are almost being encouraged to go beyond the law to impose their interpretation of it. And that's really inevitable, isn't it? When all you throw at them is this woolly operational stuff about different brains and different bodies, and if somebody feels really upset, etc. I think a door has been opened by all this self-ID and postmodernism, etc., to let something really unpleasant in. And I think we're going to be in the unfortunate experience of probably being a bit of a living experiment now and seeing to what extent police powers are going to be used to make us appropriate and good citizens.
The problem that we have in this country, and that I'm not, this is not to do the English legal system down, because it's a good system, and it's based on tried and tested, it's the best we've got, and it compares well with other countries. But there is a problem of confidence, and because we now live in a sort of tiptoeing on eggshells culture, which is again a product of victimhood based on subjective accusations that are thrown out on a whim. Nobody wants to upset anyone else for all sorts of laudable reasons. And I think, you know, the police, obviously post Stephen Lawrence, don't want to upset groups of people. There was a huge movement after the sort of decriminalisation of homosexuality to show the role that the police have played in surveilling and policing gay men. And so there's been, you know, all sorts of ways in which the police have wanted to sort of make up for lost time and show that they are, you know, not just, prejudicial, overbearing agents of the state, but also up for a laugh, a party, a festival, a bit of fun, pride, whatever, painting on your face. I mean, it all comes from a good place. But as we see, there are entities that see that as an opportunity to kind of appropriate the police for their own purposes. And the question we need to ask ourselves as a society is, how does that happen? How do the police, which are relatively impartial, apart from a few individual bad apples, I mean, relatively impartial body of people that enforce the laws, how do they become so obsessed with single issue politics? What makes them vulnerable to capture in that way? That's the question we need to ask. That's what we need to show to the politicians. If we don't know the answer directly, as in this is how it happens, we can at least map for the politicians the history of how this has happened and the stages by which certain organisations have captured the ear of government, of civil servants, and have accessed all of our public bodies and institutions through training and workshops and, you know, recruitment policies and, you know, all sorts.
But Anna, do you have any confidence that we can do anything for our members of parliament when they are actually one of the most captured bunch of the lot? I mean, that's the terrifying thing for me, that our lawmakers, our policymakers have been captured. Absolutely. I mean, look at Jo Swinson, look at Lisa Nandy.
Yes.
There are a handful of politicians prepared to speak up against what is palpably insane, to go on television and say a baby is born with no sex. This is actually coming out of the mouths of our elected politicians. I mean, I am really concerned, because I would never have said this before, 6 months ago, a year ago, that the Supreme Court judgment could actually not make any difference. So deep and grave is the level of institutional capture.
That's very, very, very true. But you could see when you had politicians on TV trying to say these things with a straight face. Obviously, Jo Swinson got absolutely mauled throughout the last general election campaign. In the Labour Party hustings, people are standing up in the audience and shouting, you know, and saying that's not true. I'm sure all these politicians are talking with their advisors and with their peers, and they are realising that there is a groundswell against all this, and it's more that they don't know how to tell the truth. They are fighting their own battles in their own minds with all this advice and capture coming from Stonewall and mermaids. But I think,
but Rob, that's the point. If they can sit back, I mean, what politician commented on Mr. Justice Knowles saying that what Harry Miller had faced was the Gestapo, the Cheka, the Stasi? That was an astonishing paragraph in the judgment.
It was, unignorable one. That's what I'm saying.
But it was largely ignored by the politicians. I mean, Jo Swinson crashed and burned. That didn't stop Lisa Nandy et al. Repeating what she was saying word for word. I mean, these politicians would quite happily have seen Harry Miller gone to prison. I'm really worried. I don't want to be alarmist. I suppose living in isolation for even only 4 days is making me feel quite concerned about where we're going with this. But I think if it had been a different judge, Harry Miller would have gone to prison. And I wouldn't, what politician would have stood up and spoke out against that? Which one of them actually referred to that judgment and said, this is such a shocking wake-up call. What have we become that we have allowed a local police force to be likened to the Gestapo? I am really shocked and saddened that that didn't have more of an impact. I don't know if that's just me being cynical. If I miss something, I don't know if you feel that it did get more play and more attention. I mean, quite a lot of journalists picked it up, but I can't recall what politicians did.
Well, it is very new, and it puts the issue on the table in a way that I would say cannot be ignored. And I think it's part of, you know, obviously it's not fair cop. There's many groups that came before us and indeed are springing up now. The pressure on politicians from our side is growing and growing and growing. It is relentless. And I think, you know, I hope we are going to see some more nuance from politicians, because they realise that Stonewall's magic words are having less and less effect on the general population. They're not scared of being called bigots or transphobes anymore. And I think politicians are just being a little bit slow to pick up on the general feeling. And I think cases like ours and the Supreme Court and all the other things that are going on with the judicial review against the Tavistock, that's just going to build and build and build. It's the question.
I hope you're right, but you use the word nuance, and that does trouble me. This isn't a nuanced issue. To say a baby is born without a sex is insane. It is a delusion. It is magical thinking of a type that should not be present in any elected member of parliament. So I am really worried. It isn't an issue of nuance. Politicians should be saying loud and clear that this is getting out of hand, has got out of hand. And I just wonder why they are not, and why the degree of capture is so immense. But if anything can turn it around, it won't be a High Court judgment, but it could be a judgment of the Supreme Court. So I'm going to try and end my contribution on a more positive note.
Okay. Anna, your thoughts on that?
Well, I think it's important to be optimistic about the amount of work that's been done and the gains that have been made through not just the case and the press coverage that it received, but in extraordinary social networks that have grown up, organisations have been formed, new personalities have become known to the public, whether Sarah, you on Twitter, and other women and men who, you know, have become known commentators on this issue and have done a really brilliant job of using the GRA as an example and the Equality Act as an example of how the public can trace the disconnect between policy and statute and how policies are being implemented and abuses thereof. And I think that's a wonderful case study of a civil public in a democratic country actually taking on the role that the politicians should take on themselves and sort of getting the job done. And I think that's really great. I also think there's a huge role in our society for Benjamin the donkey, if you recall, in Animal Farm, who doesn't do much except sort of point out that it's all a bit pointless because, you know, power corrupts. And, you know, his role is very important as well. He's a cynic and he sees the bad in every development and the potential for individuals and groups within society to gain dominance through all sorts of Machiavellian tactics, and that how difficult it is once power has been grasped by a group or an individual, how difficult it is to wrest it back. So I think there's room for both of those approaches. We have to be vigilant. We have seen through the trans issue, it's the canary in the coal mine, we've seen how easy it is for politicians, teachers, doctors, civil servants, you name it, people with high levels of education to say absolute nonsense for fear that they'll lose their public reputations or their lives or their livings, if you like. We've seen that. And we've seen how the police have rushed in and adopted absolutely unlawful stances, brazenly sometimes it seems, because they haven't stopped doing it since the judgment fell. So they're not that worried themselves about the fact that they've acted unlawfully. They seem to be more worried about, you know, annoying Stonewall. So we've seen how bad it is and how bad it gets, and that it does take civil action on the part of the population to draw attention to it. But just as I said, we've also seen how the public can galvanise and actually create an environment where people say, hang on, you know, we're not just going to sit back and allow lobby groups to determine that, you know, what we know to be scientifically true or objectively a matter of fact. We're not. Mm. Now we're seeing more doctors than ever say, you know, this is unsustainable. We can't have, I mean, look at the coronavirus. I'm a big critic of some of the legislation that's come out of that in the last few days, actually. But that's for another time. But I would say not one mention during this entire pandemic of the need to abolish sexual difference as a category for monitoring the spread of the virus. I mean, I think if you did try to say that there's no difference between men and women, when there's actually very good research that shows that it is impacting men and women differently, I think if you tried to say that that was offensive to transgender people, you wouldn't get very far in the current time. It just goes to show that a lot of this identity politics is a product of boredom in affluent societies.
Yes, we'll have to see whether the virus will make people reappraise what's really important in life. But we'll have to leave it there for the time being. Thank you so much, Anna and Sarah, for joining me again. Until our next podcast, please stay safe, look after your elderly relatives and neighbours, and if in doubt, always follow the guidance. That's the coronavirus guidance, obviously, not the College of Police's hate crimes guidance. That really would be a stupid thing to do.